The first degree.
These things are supposed to happen in movies, not in real life.
My Facebook was blowing up, but I'm like, I don't understand what's going on. What is going on here? I saw it, and then when I thought, I was like, no way. There's no way this is happening. It didn't make sense. And I think, like, she had had, like, dinner with her mom, like, the night it happened. I think there was some concern about where he was at the time, and then they noticed his arm went up and something shiny, and that's when they took out the guns and started firing, and they were firing at him. I think it's just been on my mind a lot with her. I literally think about her all the time and how senseless it was. And honestly, for the past couple of years, I've probably tried to not say anything about it because, I don't know, I just didn't want to bring up bad memories for people. But yeah. I feel like her story really needs told, though.
Welcome to The First Degree, the true crime podcast that you might end up on. My name is Jack Vanek. I'm sitting here with Alexis Linkletter again in her little First Degree merch, looking all cute, freshly highlighted hair. Like, woo. she's feeling flirty and fresh.
Honestly, she's trying not to just rot at home.
It's hard.
Rotting is like my new favorite thing to do.
Obsession.
Yeah. And I'm trying to just remind myself that I'm a social being and I can leave the house. And I should probably put in just a smidge of effort.
It's all about balance. Rotting, I always say, is good for your health. You know, it's self-care. Sometimes you really need to decompress and watch some shitty reality TV to, like, be able to refresh yourself, you know?
Oh, 100%. And speaking of which, I binged Traitors yesterday.
Oh, my God.
What a series.
Are you done with it already?
No, but I'm mesmerized. Obviously, we're talking about season two. These Traitors are doing a really good job.
I mean, it's amazing.
They're duping. I'm at episode 5. They've duped and duped and duped some more, and I love it.
Oh, just wait. It gets crazy. No spoilers, but man, no that spoilers. Show's so good.
Gosh.
Before we start today's podcast, I thought I would just throw it out into the beginning of the episode. If you would like to send us a story, if you have a story to tell, please email us. hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com. We are always looking for new submissions. We don't reach out to anybody. We take them from you, and we'd love to hear from you.
And if you sent a story a while back, like 2 years back or something, just send it again. It might have gone to spam. Now I check spam. I could have been overwhelmed and it slipped through the cracks, which often happens. So just try again, and I'll try to respond to everybody.
Perfect. Well, yes. I think that is enough of that. So let's turn down the lights.
And turn up your anxiety.
Because this could be you.
We all know that domestic violence is one of the leading causes of death for women worldwide, period. In fact, for women in the U.S., homicide is the leading cause of death for those who are pregnant, which is an insane statistic. I had no idea. And we know that the impact of deaths from domestic violence is felt far and wide by everyone in a community, regardless of whether or not you knew the victim, perpetrator, or both. Loved ones are the ones who are left to pick up the pieces when someone is murdered by an abuser, questioning what they could have done differently, if anything, to prevent such violence from happening. But there's another group of people we don't often talk about in the broader discussion of analyzing the aftermath of domestic violence homicides. Emergency services personnel, especially police officers, are the ones who respond to these calls day in and day out. And sometimes when they arrive on scene, it's too late to save a woman's life. This is where domestic violence claims more victims than just the target of the perpetrator's rage. The resulting guilt, and oftentimes PTSD, that plagues police officers who respond to these incidents is something that can stay with them forever. Cops working as the good guys, they're devastated when a life is lost in front of them. And these good cops who police with integrity are sometimes forgotten in the domestic violence discourse.
We begin today's case on June 26th of 2009. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled a strip search of a 13-year-old Arizona teenager was illegal after school officials stripped the young woman looking for prescription drugs.
Unreal.
It's unreal.
Insane. Oh my gosh.
13 years old.
What the fuck?
The entertainment world was mourning the death of Farrah Fawcett, who passed away the day before from cancer, age 62, which is so sad.
So sad.
And as did Michael Jackson, apparently following a heart attack, and he was only 50. I think we all remember it was one of those things you remember where you were when you heard that Michael Jackson died.
And he overshadowed Farrah Fawcett. And that, yes. I remember thinking that no one was talking about Farrah Fawcett because of Michael Jackson, which I thought was so sad. So I'm glad we're putting her at the front and center.
You know what? I didn't even know she was dead. So
the same day, because it was the same time as Michael Jackson.
That's so crazy. Yeah. So speaking of pop music, Boom Boom Pow by the Black Eyed Peas was the number one song on the charts. And they also took out the number two spot with their brand new single, I Got a Feeling. That's a crazy world when the Black Eyed Peas are number one and number two.
Especially considering their lyrics are like, what kind of night it's going to be? A good night. Like the most basic lyrics maybe ever.
Yeah, they're something. For movies at the box office, people were going to see the second installment of the Transformers series, Revenge of the Fallen. And people were also going to see the rom-com, The Proposal, starring Sandra Bullock and Ryan Reynolds.
And the setting for today's story is Fayetteville, Arkansas. In northwest Arkansas in Washington County, the city of about 95,000 people sits about 185 miles northwest of Little Rock. Not to be confused with its namesake in North Carolina and other states, Fayetteville is actually named after the same place in Tennessee. In Ozark Territory near the Boston Mountains, the city is known as the track capital of the world, thanks to the University of Arkansas's prestigious track and field programs. It's also the former home of First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton, who in the 1970s helped establish the city's first ever rape crisis center. Fayetteville, or more specifically, the nearby area of Springdale, is also where our first degree for today's case, Stacy, went to high school.
And it was there that Stacy met a girl named Jill, as they both attended the same church and high school. Jill was one of three children born to her parents, Jim and Kay, and grew up with her brother and sister. She absolutely loved kids and, as a young woman, taught church classes to the congregation's young children. Jill was also a Girl Scout with her local troop.
So I moved to Arkansas when I was in high school. I met her when I was at a church that she went to, and then we kept running into each other like through the halls in high school. And so she was always really sweet, was always nice and willing to give anybody just like basically have a shirt off her back kind of thing. I went to like the youth group for Wednesday nights for a little bit. That's where I really like actually got to talk to her and get to know her a little bit and everything.
After Jill graduated from Springdale High School in 2001, by happenstance, she and Stacy both ended up at the University of Arkansas. And after reconnecting, the pair remained in touch throughout their college years.
After we graduated high school, I went 2 years at a community college and then I transferred. So when I transferred is when I kept running into her all the time. We were at the same college together. I think she graduated like the year after I did, but I would always run into her on campus while I was up there. I think I ran into her more in college than I did in high school.
During college, Jill was known as the type of person who looked for the good in everybody, and Stacy remembered her like this in high school. She was always smiling and ready with a patient and empathetic ear when those around her were going through tough times.
But sometimes people took advantage of Jill's sweet and caring nature. In February of 2005, the 21-year-old was granted a 2-year protective order against her boyfriend at the time, who had multiple felony convictions for battery and drug offenses.
And his ongoing drug use led to irrational and violent behavior. On at least one occasion, he choked Jill, which led to the protective order, in which he wrote, "Every time I talk to him about drugs, he gets angry, and I fear he will get violent again."
Thankfully, Jill escaped that relationship and left this loser in the dust. And in 2007, she graduated from college with a Bachelor of Arts degree.
She was working on trying to become a teacher. She had graduated like a semester or a year after I had already graduated.
Jill and Stacy stayed in touch when they could, but obviously adult life starts to divert our attention elsewhere after we graduate from college. Kids, careers, and other pursuits mean we don't often get to maintain contact as much as we would like with our friends from our childhood. You catch up when you can, but a year can go by so fast.
Then, one day in the summer of 2009, Stacy was scrolling through Facebook when she saw something that stopped her in her tracks.
Facebook was just becoming a thing when I was in college, and my Facebook was blowing up, but I'm like, I don't understand what's going on. What is going on here? I saw it, and then when I saw it, I was like, no way. There's no way this is happening. It didn't make sense. I think the biggest one that started, like, circulating is the girl that she was, like, super close with. Like, you would not see one without the other, pretty much. And when she posted something, that's when I was like, okay, I know. It was just crazy because I had never experienced anything like this either before this had happened. Like, I never had a friend pass. And then I had also never had a friend who, like, you find out that they're passed from, like, social media, even at that point. You were very skeptical of it, I guess, until you actually saw, like, certain people posting. You were like, okay, I don't believe this.
Stacy was stunned and overwhelmed to hear that her friend had died. She felt shock, confusion, and grief. What happened to Jill? The post indicated that this wasn't an accident, so who would do this to her and why? To answer all the questions, you know the drill. We got to go back.
After college, Jill plans to start a career as a history teacher. But for reasons that aren't readily apparent, by early 2009, she was working for a pest control company. And by this time, she was also in a relationship with an older man named Ricky Anderson. And he worked at a steak restaurant in Springdale.
The couple had been living together since October of 2008 in the Raspberry Place apartment complex, and this was at 2182 North Leverett Avenue in a second-story unit. This was a densely populated part of town just north of the University of Arkansas. Jill and Ricky's neighbors thought the couple seemed really happy and really affectionate, and that they were both just relatively nice people.
Stacy hadn't met Ricky, but knew enough to realize that apart from Jill's ex, he wasn't the typical kind of guy that she went for.
I didn't know anything about him. Like, I had knew that there had been other boyfriends. I don't think she had ever even dealt with a situation like this before, because everybody that she had ever dated was always usually sweet. And she always had such kind things to say about them. So I almost think that there was a part of her that was over her head a little bit.
41-year-old Ricky had a prior criminal record and was released on parole from an Oklahoma prison in May of 2008, less than 6 months before he and Jill moved in together. He'd been serving 25 years for multiple charges committed in Oklahoma City, including armed robbery, and would be on parole until January of 2015. But just 4 months after his release, Ricky was caught drunk driving in Farmington on the outskirts of Fayetteville.
He was in jail in Oklahoma. I think he was, like, paroled early or something.
That same month, a marriage license was issued for Ricky and another woman. So, not Jill. Another woman named Cheryl in Sequoia County in Oklahoma. So, now the chronology here isn't clear about exactly when Ricky was believed to have met Cheryl or how or when he would have been dating Jill and slash moving in with Jill. We don't know whether Jill knew Ricky was married. But from what Stacy knows of her friend, Jill definitely wouldn't have gotten mixed up in a relationship with Ricky if she knew he was newly married to someone. And even though we can't say for sure, it appears there was some overlap here.
I think probably of all things, that's probably the one thing that bothered me the most, because I don't think she would have gotten involved with somebody that she knew was already in a relationship. I know around the time there was also, like, news reports and stuff coming out that, like, the person he was actually legally married to, they had met in the prison before he had gotten out or something. I don't know if they had had a relationship before he got out, but then when he got out, I guess they, like, married.
In December of 2008, Ricky's request to transfer his parole from Oklahoma to Arkansas was granted. And the following month, he had his first meeting with his Arkansas parole officer. So it seemed that apart from the drunk driving charge, Ricky was, you know, being compliant and things were going well because he and Jill had moved in together at that point.
But in early February of 2009, the wheels started to fall off in this relationship. And when Jill had enough of Ricky's behavior, because it had been escalating for a while, in this, I guess, the straw that broke the camel's back is that Jill found him smoking crack in their apartment. And she was so angry about this that she took pictures and sent them to his parole officer. Obviously, Ricky is super upset when this happens, but Jill's like not putting up with this bullshit. Like, she wants a man who's going to show up, abide by his parole officer's rules, don't smoke crack at home. I don't think that's too much to ask.
So Jill told their landlord, who prohibited Ricky from entering the property, and he also recommended that Jill get an order of protection. And, you know, it's really heartwarming to hear that they had Jill's back. A lot of the times, landlords don't give a fuck about their tenants at all.
Very dismissive.
Yes. So Jill went ahead and took his advice. She got the order of protection, and it was granted.
Right. So in her application, she wrote that, quote, "Ricky has threatened me with violence before. Said he would beat me so bad I couldn't call the police and told me he would kill me. I have no doubt that if he found out I called his parole officer, that he would try to kill me." But what was even more disturbing about this is Jill also wrote, quote, "Called the police once before and called police this morning. They couldn't make him leave because he is on the lease," end quote. So all we can say about this, hopefully this has changed in Arkansas, because that's terrifying. That's the last thing women need, is to feel like they can't call the cops on someone threatening violence because they're on a lease. Like, that shouldn't matter.
Things got worse for Ricky when he was also arrested for violating his parole. He hadn't informed his parole officer of his address and was therefore living in an unapproved location. 5 days later, Ricky was released from Washington County Jail after his parole violation over the address issue was resolved.
But then Jill seemed to have a change of heart. Just 3 days after Ricky's release, Jill asked the court to dismiss the order of protection. Jill was obviously a sweet and forgiving person and wanted to see the best in people. But we all know how the cycle of domestic abuse works and unfolds.
No doubt Ricky had likely been sufficiently contrite, at least on the surface, convincing Jill that things would be different moving forward and manipulating her into believing that he would change, that he loved her, and all the usual crap that abusers like to spin when somebody holds them accountable for their actions. In her request to the court, Jill wrote, "He didn't respond to my calling his parole officer like I expected. He realizes his mistake and chooses to start doing and acting right. And I want to be able to help him by giving him emotional and spiritual help."
But in a surprise to no one, Ricky's promises were hollow. In late May, neighbors said they began hearing the couple fighting once again. Jill threw Ricky out, and he went to go live in Farmington, but he still had a key to their place.
Then, on June 7th, Ricky was arrested for destroying $1,600 worth of Jill's property at the apartment. She came home to find Ricky had gained access to the apartment and trashed her iPod, her 19-inch high-definition TV, hairdryer, iron, camera, and some of her clothing.
Ricky was arrested for first-degree criminal mischief and thrown in jail for the next 13 days. As well as reporting the incident to police, Jill sought a second order of protection, this time alleging that Ricky had not only threatened her, but raped her a few days before. In her application, Jill wrote, quote, "He told me if he ever saw me again, he'd make it where no one else would ever want me again." So threatening, like, disfigurement, like, that's a crazy fucking threat.
That's really, really terrifying.
Terrifying.
I know for sure, though, that, like, the first order of protection, she had asked to let it go. And then she filed another one after he, like, came there and, like, trashed her place again. I know that was one part of it. And he had already violated, I think, the first order of protection when it was still in effect before she had, like, taken it away. Like, he had already had a history of violating orders of protection.
Ricky was ordered by a Washington County judge not to have any contact whatsoever with Jill. Jill told her neighbors about a new order of protection and that if they saw Ricky or anyone associated with him, to call the police. Meanwhile, authorities sent a request for revocation of Ricky's parole to Oklahoma, meaning they wanted him back in Oklahoma. Like, they didn't want this fucking problem.
Yeah.
I would do the same thing, though, if I was a parole officer in Arkansas. It's like, why is this guy our problem now?
I know.
Like, he can't follow the rules. Take him back.
Yeah, he's just causing a mess everywhere he goes.
Totally.
So on June 18th, Ricky was released when he posted the $3,500 bond set by the court. And by this time, Oklahoma had understandably washed its hands of Ricky's parole supervision, declining their request of revocation and making him the responsibility of the state of Arkansas.
Despite the order of protection, the next day, Ricky texted and called Jill when she was at work. So she called the police, who arrested him where he was living in Farmington. I mean, he's breaking his order of protection. Unbelievably, the bond for violating the order of protection was only $1,000. So when Ricky paid up, he was released. He didn't even have to appear before a judge, because breaching an order of protection in Arkansas at that time was a misdemeanor and not a felony. Then, 3 days later, Ricky missed a meeting with his parole officer.
June 26 began like any other normal day for Jill, until she again began receiving repeated calls and text messages from Ricky. At 5 p.m., he also called her mom, Kay, telling her he was in Oklahoma City on his way to the hospital because he had overdosed, which is really random and probably a lie, but Ricky was not anybody else's responsibility.
Right, and Kay and Jill had dinner plans that night, and afterwards, Jill drove back home in her black Chevy pickup. But when she got inside the apartment and looked out her window, she saw something that chilled her to the bone.
She saw Ricky getting out of a dark gray Scion, which apparently belonged to his supposed wife. He was walking across the parking lot toward Jill's apartment, and he was carrying something.
I think, like, she had had, like, dinner with her mom, like, the night it happened. Like, before she had went home. I think there was some concern about where he was at the time, and the mom, she had called him to find out, like, where he was. And he had said something like Oklahoma City or something. If you know or could see on a map this part of Arkansas, like, the northwest portion, like, Oklahoma City is a good 3.5 hours away. It wasn't expected that he was even going to be in the area. And then when she got home, that's when she, like, saw his figure, like, coming towards her apartment.
At 10:32 p.m., 26-year-old Jill called 911, telling the operator she could see Ricky in the parking lot, headed in the direction of the building. She told the dispatcher that her ex drank, did cocaine, and was on parole for aggravated assault and robbery. Two officers who we're going to call for the purpose of this episode, Officer Wilson and Officer Sanders, were quickly dispatched and arrived on scene 6 minutes later in separate patrol cars.
They noticed a vehicle matching the description of the one that Jill provided to the dispatchers. Jill was still on the line and told the dispatcher she stepped outside of her front door at the top of the stairs. At this moment, Officer Sanders saw what he described as a dark figure at Jill's door.
As Officer Wilson approached Jill's building, he then heard a blood-curdling scream. When he looked up to where it was coming from, he saw a door slam shut from inside. Without hesitating, he followed Officer Sanders up the stairs, where Officer Sanders tried to kick the door open before shoving it in with his shoulder.
But the door was solid, like a fire door, and wouldn't budge despite the officer's valiant efforts. This entire time, the screaming continued, unrelenting, as both officers desperately tried to get inside the apartment.
Having no luck with the door, Officer Wilson ran over to the living room window, which was at ground level, and kicked it in, smashing the glass. Pulling the curtains aside, he could see Ricky squatting or kneeling behind the couch, with just a small portion of his head visible above the back of the couch. He was bobbing up and down like he was punching someone, but because it was dark inside, it was difficult to see.
Officer Sanders drew his taser and fired at Ricky in an attempt to incapacitate him, but he missed. Officer Wilson had also drawn his taser, but then he saw Ricky raise a knife in his right hand and bring it down with a strong stabbing motion behind the couch. Officer Wilson dropped his taser and yelled, "Knife!" Without hesitating, he drew his Glock and fired at Ricky, as did Officer Sanders.
Officers could hear that Jill was still screaming for help, but Ricky continued his assault. The officers tried to stop him by firing 9 rounds in total until eventually Jill stopped screaming and Ricky stopped moving.
The officers then saw Ricky roll away from where he was positioned and lie still on the floor. Jill, who lay in a pool of blood, wasn't moving either.
Officer Sanders climbed in through the window to find a bloody knife lying on the floor near Ricky, who was miraculously uninjured. Like, how?
Insane.
Keeping his gun trained on Ricky and shouting at him to stay down, Officer Sanders let Officer Wilson in through the door. Ricky started babbling about the real attacker, I'm using air quotes as I record this, having escaped out of the back of the apartment. But obviously the police had seen him do this.
I mean, that's so insane he even tried to do that.
A loser.
My God. Tragically, Jill had succumbed to multiple stab wounds and died at the scene. Ricky was detained and taken into custody, where he continued this bullshit story claiming that a man named Greg, who obviously was never found because he was never real, was the real perpetrator and had fled the apartment after being shot twice.
Reminder, the police saw him enter the apartment.
I know.
And saw him also making that stabbing motion behind the couch. Like, this guy's a
joke. Was no other person there.
Correct.
He was arrested on site because he was pretty much caught in the scene of the crime.
Jill's autopsy revealed more heartbreaking information. Not only had she sustained 27 stab wounds, several of which were fatal, but in the chaos, a round from one of the officer's weapons had struck Jill in the head. The official cause of death were stab wounds and a gunshot. The reason the officers hadn't realized immediately that Jill had been shot was that her stab wounds were so severe. Everyone was heartbroken, including these officers who had been trying to save Jill's life.
I don't think they realized until after he was already arrested what had actually happened. I think what made it more tragic is because, like, they were trying to help her and get him off of her, and just a ricochet hit her in the head, too.
It was definitely not an intentional, because by the time they were able to start, like, breaking the window to the apartment and all of that, by that point, they had tried tasers, I think, first, and they couldn't reach him or it wasn't phasing him. Then they noticed his arm went up and something shiny, and that's when they took out the guns and started firing. And they were firing at him, but he was behind a couch with her.
To make it even more tragic, it also emerged that Jill was pregnant with Ricky's child. Jill had known she was pregnant before she was murdered, and it was said that she was really excited, having shared the happy news with her family and her neighbors.
She was still in the first trimester. It was definitely she would have known, because I remember her mom and sister talking about it, like, after she had passed, and they knew it was his.
Ricky was held without bail and initially charged with second-degree murder. If convicted, he was looking at between 5 to 30 years in prison, not nearly enough. But the investigation was continuing, and there was every possibility the charges could be upgraded to capital murder. If prosecutors could prove premeditation and deliberation, Ricky was facing either life without parole or the death penalty.
Ricky told detectives that he went to Jill's apartment to help her get her TV back from this mystery guy named Greg, who was apparently already at the apartment. And according to Ricky, he went inside the apartment, locked the door, and turned his back to Greg and Jill until the police arrived, which, apart from not making literally any sense ever, is the biggest bunch of bullshit that we've ever heard. I can't believe that he even tried to do this.
Yeah, unreal. And when officers Wilson and Sanders learned that a bullet from one of their service weapons had been one of the wounds that Jill sustained, obviously, they were beside themselves. They had been trying to save Jill's life. Understandably, they went on to experience symptoms of PTSD, and guilt and the what-ifs kind of consumed them, like it would anyone. I mean, this is so tragic. Both officers knew the incident would automatically trigger an independent investigation by the county sheriff's office into their actions. The two officers were placed on paid administrative leave, and the process kicked into gear for a mandatory critical incident stress debriefing, which is what occurs anytime an officer has been involved in a shooting.
The officers felt supported, but they were obviously still in shock at what had occurred, and they were anxious about the outcome. After all, this did have the potential to be a career-ending misconduct.
even if it wasn't, despite the fact they'd follow their training to the letter, nothing can change the fact that an innocent young woman and her unborn child were gone. And yes, the alleged perpetrator was off the street, but this was cold comfort.
Both officers later independently said that when they realized Jill had died at the scene, they fought the urge to want to shoot Ricky dead. But they didn't, because they knew it wasn't worth it, and on reflection, they knew they'd made the right decision.
Thankfully, and to the credit of Jill's family, they had the officers' backs. Jill's parents, who sound like truly incredible people, caring people, shared open support for the officers and said they wouldn't hear a bad word said about the men who had tried to save their daughter to the best of their ability. Jill's parents even invited the officers to sit with them at Jill's funeral, which, like, kind of gives me the chills.
Yeah.
Which Stacy, our first degree, also attended to say farewell to her friend.
It was rough. I feel like it, like, devastated them so deeply. They just were trying to get through it at that point. Both officers that responded were actually pretty devastated about it. I know they showed up at our funeral, which was really, really hard. Her parents had gotten up and, like, made a big thing of, like, yes, we know this happened, but they were also, like, the police were just trying to save her and do what they could in their power. So there was no, like, blame going on from her family to the police at all. They were so sweet. They've always kind of had the most kind of loving heart. And obviously they were devastated, but even, like, before all of that, they were so forgiving and so caring. It didn't help that the media around the time was also saying stuff like the police are the ones that actually killed her and all of this. But in the autopsy, there was his stab wounds had cut multiple arteries that she could have lived with, like being severed. And she was pregnant.
And you just heard that Stacy mentioned that Jill wouldn't have survived her stab wounds, and this was actually true. During Jill's autopsy, the medical examiner found that Ricky had severed a major artery in Jill's abdomen. One of her stabbing injuries was so catastrophic that even if somebody had been on scene to treat Jill immediately, and even if she hadn't sustained a fatal gunshot wound, she wouldn't have made it to the hospital for the surgery that she needed to survive.
The ME had came out saying, like, that multiple stab wounds that he had done would have caused her to die anyway, because she would have bled out in like 5 minutes. There was no way they could have got, even though there was a hospital like close by, there's no way they could have gotten her to a hospital, to an operating room, to have made a difference.
When the ballistics and the nature of Jill's head wound were analyzed, it turned out that Jill hadn't been directly struck by a bullet from one of the police officer's service weapons. So as we know, the officers had been shooting at Ricky to try to incapacitate him to stop this attack on Jill. And 8 of these bullets flew over or sort of hit this section where they could see the top of Ricky's head. But one of them had ricocheted off a spring in this couch and the wooden frame of the couch, which actually affected the way the bullet moved through the air.
According to the Journal of Forensic Sciences, things like bullet shape and other factors determine whether it will ricochet. When a bullet strikes a surface, like the couch spring and the frame in this instance, it loses energy, but it can still retain sufficient energy to kill someone or seriously injure them.
This means, to just put it in layman's terms, is that these officers didn't shoot Jill. Their bullet bounced off something, and then it hit her. This is just like a one in a million freak accident, and they actually did a great job in trying to incapacitate this guy. So you might wonder whether the officers should have reasonably known whether their bullets would ricochet and possibly pose a risk to Jill's life. But a bullet's trajectory after ricochet is generally impossible to predict. Like, we're talking physics, we're talking geometry, so many variables, so many mathematical elements that contribute to whether this happens. Aside from that, the officers didn't know exactly where Jill was behind the couch because her location was obstructed by the couch. And again, they were firing at Ricky. They were obviously not trying to hit Jill.
And you'll be relieved to know that the officers Wilson and Sanders were ultimately cleared of any wrongdoing. And in July of 2009, it was announced that no charges would be laid against them. Both officers were found to have been completely justified in using Arkansas law around the use of deadly force to defend Jill because they believed correctly that Ricky was trying to kill her.
I think also, like, at the time, domestic violence, assaults and homicides and all of that was just really more, things were actually starting to be done about it. Like, people were actually starting to speak up and everything.
Ricky's charges were upgraded to capital murder on July 24th after the evidence revealed he'd acted with premeditation, which Arkansas law says can be formed in an instant. But he wouldn't be charged with the murder of Jill's unborn child, given she was less than 12 weeks into the pregnancy. Nonetheless, Ricky pleaded not guilty to capital murder and criminal mischief.
I know at one point the prosecution was trying to go for the death penalty, and then eventually it was taken off the table.
At the trial the following year, Ricky went through at least 7 different lawyers. He attempted to argue that his culpability was lessened because one of Jill's wounds was caused by the actions of one of the officers. He didn't want evidence admitted about Jill's pregnancy either, claiming this evidence was prejudicial.
However, the evidence was admitted, and it was central to the prosecution's case that the pregnancy was what motivated Ricky to murder Jill. Of the 27 stab wounds Jill suffered, 13 of them were to her abdomen.
It ended up coming out that he did know that she was pregnant. It also had came out that, like, he didn't want her to have the child. And I know that was part of it, but also I think he was just, if I can't have you, then no, like, you're not going to get out of this.
The defense even went so far as to infer that the officers may have been the ones to kill Jill, and then they covered it up. This bullshit and, quite frankly, offensive argument was later totally shot down by the judge. The bottom line was that Ricky was solely responsible for Jill's death.
Ricky was found guilty of capital murder on September 16th of 2010, and the jury recommended the 43-year-old be sentenced to life in prison without parole, which is what he received. At sentencing, the judge spoke specifically to the courageous actions of Officers Sanders and Wilson, saying, quote, "It's clear to me that these two officers acted professionally and responsibly. They acted as I would want them to act if someone were trying to kill me. They did exactly what they were required to do, and in my judgment, it's unfortunate that this approach was taken."
Following the trial, Jill's family invited the officers and their families over for a barbecue. They were deeply appreciative of the officers' actions that night and wanted to ensure that they were getting the support that they needed to heal. And the community also got behind Jill's family when the Fayetteville Exchange Club later named them Officers of the Year.
Honestly, that makes me, like, I'm not crying, but it chokes me up. Like, yeah. The ability to do something like that, because even if you don't blame the officers, you think that'd be such a source of pain, like, with this loss. Their ability to do this is so inspiring, the family.
Absolutely.
So in November of 2011, Ricky's appeal was dismissed by the Supreme Court of Arkansas. He subsequently made further appeals for post-conviction relief and further testing of evidence at the crime scene in 2015, 2016, and 2019. But thankfully, all of these were denied.
Stacy shared her final thoughts with us on what compelled her to come forward to tell Jill's story.
I think it's just been on my mind a lot with her. I literally think about her all the time and how senseless it was. And honestly, for the past couple of years, I've probably tried to not say anything about it because, I don't know, I just didn't want to bring up bad memories for people. But yeah. I feel like her story really needs told, though. I think one thing for sure is that she's not here. There's not even a chance to, like, run into her somewhere or, you know, message her on Facebook and, like, hey, let's catch up. You can't do that. Like, why did he have to choose her? Like, stay in another state where you were. And also, weren't you married? Like, there's just so many things, like, from that perspective that just drive me crazy.
Sadly, with Jill's story, there are so many what-ifs and ways that this could have ended differently. She did everything right, and ultimately choosing herself and her unborn baby's safety over a toxic and abusive relationship. She contacted the police, reported everything, and jumped through all the hoops. Remember, she was sending evidence to Ricky's probation officer. She was taking big risks to protect herself, hoping that justice would unfold in a way that would. And so as we often see with these stories, the law has a long way to go in being able to protect women in a meaningful way. But when Jill needed help in that terrifying moment, when she dialed 911, it is heartening to know that even though someone intent on violence ultimately did take her life, those who are there to serve and protect stepped up to do everything in their power to save her. There's only one person to be blamed here for what happened to Jill, and he'll have the rest of his life to live with those consequences.
Huge thank you to Stacey for being our first degree guest for this episode. Like we said in the beginning, if you are listening and you have a story to tell, please email us hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com. You can follow us on Instagram, join our Facebook. We're talking true crime all the time. Join our Patreon if you want more first degree content. We have a full-length true crime episode for you every single week over there. And stick around tomorrow. We'll have a brand new episode of Killing Time right in your feed.
That's right. And remember, only you can prevent serial killers.
And keep your friends close.
But not that close. Shout out to Jared Monaco for scoring original music for The First Degree, producing by Caitlin Cleveland, writing and research by Gemma Harris. Sources for this episode are Court Records, the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, the Northwest Arkansas Times, Fox News, the U.S. Department of Justice, KNWA News, the University of Arkansas Criminal Justice Institute, ArkansasLawHelp.org, and Five News. And as always, our first degree guest is always our largest source.